This is Main Street on Prairie Public, the time and place that we gather around these Main Street microphones, just like the main streets across this state. And we have good conversations. We greet our friends. We learn about the news of the day. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today on the show, it is Labor Day. We are going to look into the value of work with a preview from the Wise Show. But first, language has incredible power. A mother coos first words to a new baby. You accept a life-changing job. Say I do. Recoil at rejection. Maybe you've been called a hate-filled slur or used one yourself. Like technology, language itself is neither good nor bad, but endlessly malleable, depending on how it's used. Don Duncan is a professor of English and Global Studies at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota. Hamida Dakani is a community organizer running the Afro-American Development Association. She is also a student at North Dakota State University. They're my guests today. On the surface, they don't have much in common. There's an age gap. Duncan is white. Dakani is black. They have different faiths. They're from opposite sides of the globe. They're friends because of an effort called Narrative 4. Its mission, to build a community of empathetic global citizens. They do this through story exchanges, with a bit of a twist. Picture this. Take your political leanings, sit face-to-face with someone who's on the opposite side of the political spectrum, and share your personal journey. After that, your partner tells your story, as if it was his or her own. And these story exchanges aren't just about politics. They can be about topics from all walks of life. Duncan is Narrative 4's program director for Minnesota and the Dakotas. She's friends with Narrative 4 chairman Colin McCann. They met when he spoke at Concordia College. They became fast friends because they share a passion for the power of storytelling.
I truly believe that stories heal us. They do. And they heal individuals, they heal communities, they're powerful. Now, that doesn't mean they don't have some hurt in them. Medicine can taste terrible. You have surgery, that hurts. But what should be the end result of that piece? For me, not for everybody, I realize, but for me, the end result should be healing. Did it make me laugh and heal me? Did it make me cry and heal me? Did it make me feel for another, feel with another and heal me? Did it help me heal someone else? That's what it is.
Hamida, you have participated in these story exchanges, and to briefly describe what they are, because they are pretty magnificent in scope, is it brings together people from diverse and usually sort of opposite backgrounds. It might be a native-born American talking to an immigrant. They might be speaking with a refugee. It might be Caucasian people and Native Americans comparing experiences. And you tell your story to each other, and then the other person gets to tell your story. So, Hamida, I would tell your story as if it were mine, and you would tell my story as if it were yours. Don just said, these are meant for healing. Do you feel like that was your experience?
Well, yeah, you know, being an African, stories being part of my coming, you know, every night we are told stories by grandma, aunties, uncle. But what Narrative 4 does is different than the story you just tell. This is, you are walking in someone else's shoes, you know, and you are given the opportunity and the trust to tell someone's story, something very private and very dear to their heart. And it has changed my life so much. And you know, as Dan said, it is words of healing. I agree that. And also, when I was young, I was also told, you know, words will never break your bone. And that is a lie. I agree with you. That is a lie. It does. I have been called names. And sometimes, as grown up as I am, it just pisses me off. And I cry out of that. So I agree. Words can break you, you know, somehow. Not your bones, but deep your feelings. So what Narrative 4 does is it gives meaning to those stories. It's not just a story. So for me, as you said, I shared my story with a white lady. And ironically, she was a Kenyan, and I'm a Kenyan too. So we had some similarity other than being a human being raised in Kenya, mm-hmm. you know, and it was amazing. There's no word you can describe unless you do and feel it. It's a feeling that you have to feel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you try to put some words behind that feeling of listening to your story come out of someone else's mouth?
Well, first of all, I am a little judgmental. So what I learned is I cannot judge someone who's telling my story. Mm-hmm. So it's my words that you're saying. So you cannot just be judging, you know, your own story. And when others are saying it, even if it's yours, you still have part of you that feels the sympathy, you know. You're with these people. You're not just listening your story. It sounds all new, and then it takes you in a level that you have this feeling that, oh, this is what people, you know, go through, or, oh, this is how people's life is. So you're going to find a lot of similarity, but at the same time, we're different and unique in our own ways.
Mm-hmm.
But the story will bring people closer, and just, as I said, there's no word to describe.
I just heard you say you heard your story new, right? It was different and fresh.
It yeah. is. That's what I just said. Like, it's your own story, but again, you listen it by someone else saying it all sounds new, and then you just think about it as a different story, even if it's something you have lived with it for all your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You almost get a little bit of that other person's interpretation of your story, too?
Somehow, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I discovered the first time that I did this that my partner kind of heard what I didn't say, too, right? Picked up on my feelings and picked up on my body language. So when she told my story, she might have used the words she would choose to describe what she knew I was feeling. And that helped me hear my story new, as you just said. I was like, oh, because when we tell our stories, we're caught up in them.
Yes.
But when we hear our story told,
yeah.
Whoa. I like the way you said you learned to feel for yourself. That's right.
That's true.
Yeah.
How much of your story would you like to share today with our radio audience?
Well, it depends how much they want to hear. I was born in Kenya, northern Kenya. Probably most people know because that is where the refugee camp is. I was born there, and then I did my education in all of them in Kenya. And I moved here recently in 2011, July 4th. I came to Minneapolis, and then it was summer. I came a good time, not knowing there's a snow. And then I moved the same year, 2011, December, to North Dakota for school. So my journey was never easy. From childhood to high school, and then from high school, I left home at a young age and learned to, you know, to do my own things and not only support myself, but support my family and go to school and just do the thing that everyone else is doing. That is my journey to here. There's a lot into it, but that is basically the basic.
Is it okay to take the narrative for story exchange approach? Dawn, you are familiar with her story. Do you want to tell your interpretation, what you heard about Hamida's life?
Well, I don't want to say anything that I've heard that she didn't share right here.
Okay.
But what I did hear, and if I were taking notes, if Hamida and I had been paired to share, and I were taking notes at the end of our time, because I would just listen, right? I'd never interrupt her. I might ask her a clarifying question that would occur to me right now. So she talked about the refugee camps in Kenya. And Hamida, I know that you are ethnically Somali. And so I would say, so did you grow up in the refugee camps or no?
No. I was not raised in the refugee camp, but it was just a few blocks away. So you just go, like you can walk to there. It's just a few miles away. Mm-hmm. So I just go, and I had a lot of friends there and just, you know, stuff like that, but not raised in the refugee camp.
Okay, so then I would tell it like this. I would say, hi, my name is Hamida, And this is my story about coming to America. I was born and raised in the north of Kenya. And I'm ethnically Somali, and the refugee camps are in the northern part of Kenya, but I did not grow up in the refugee camp. I grew up a few blocks away. But I learned to be very responsible early in life. I learned to do things to take care of my family, and I left home when I was young. And I came to America on July 4th, 2011, which is kind of interesting. That's Independence Day in America. And I came to Minneapolis. And that was a good time to come because it was the summer, and so we didn't have the snow in the winter. And I'm not used to winter, so I wasn't then, and so it was good to come in the summer. But then I moved to North Dakota, to Fargo, in December to go to school. And I have been here since then. I go to NDSU. And that's the basics of how I got here. And that is my story. Now, we didn't hear an awful lot, but you notice that I try to stay true to what she said. And I begin with, my name is Hamida. And I end with, that is my story. And usually, if we were sitting right next to each other, we'd probably hug, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I saw some smiling, some nodding. A couple times where I'm not sure, maybe I'm reading into this, but it almost felt like you purposely weren't making eye contact with Dawn.
I wasn't, because it's just like a new thing. Even though I just said in a minute ago, it sounds new to me again, even if it's my own story that I just said. So I was avoiding the eye contact, because some things, when I talked about leaving home at a young age, that could make me emotional. So I was avoiding the eye contact for that reason. Yeah.
Which is the interesting part. In the trust circle, we wouldn't be across from each other as we are now in the studio. We'd be sitting next to each other. So you wouldn't have to worry about looking directly into each other's face. You have the physical presence and support of sitting alongside one another, right?
Okay. Yes.
And then you can reach over and touch when you want. But, yeah.
Have you seen or experienced at all during these story exchanges, you know, if you get a classic couple story where they talk about how they met, and there's always one person who says it one way and then the next person interrupts and goes, that's not how it happened. And, you know, that's just every couple seems to have a story like that. Do you run into situations where you can tell someone really wants to interrupt and say, don't tell my story like that?
I've only ever seen that once, and it was when we did the large story exchange with gun rights activists and victims of gun violence, and then the police officers and legislators. And the reason I saw that happen is it was the one and only time in all the story exchanges we've been doing over the last 2 years that I witnessed someone refuse to tell their partner's story in first person. And we will never allow that to happen again. It really caught us by surprise. It allowed that woman to distance her partner and objectify her again and tell a story about her rather than be with her in the story. And of course you could see that the other person was very upset. We were all very upset, and we said something about it. But in the exchanges I facilitated here, that has never happened. It will never happen, because I won't let it happen. And also, when we introduce what we're doing and we model the process, the facilitator and another person who's already participated once, we make a point to say, this is not about getting those details exact, right? It is not like, what, how old were you when you left? You know, it's not about those details. It's about the spirit of the story. And I loved the way Hamida said that she, would usually be judgmental, but she learned not to be judgmental doing this. Because part of what we talk about is generosity. You have to have a generosity of spirit that allows you to let go and let that other person move with you through that story. And if you do that, well, it just breaks your heart wide open, is sometimes what we say. Yeah, it does. Yeah.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public, and we're visiting with Don Duncan and Hamida Dekhani. They're both active in Narrative 4, a global effort to build community through story exchanges. We'll be back with more after this.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 64 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota, and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric and telephone cooperatives. And by Fort Union Trading Post National Historic Site, west of Williston on Highway 1804, a place of extraordinary people from different nations building community together in new and often trying circumstances. Unearth the past. Discover today.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Today on the show, the power of language to heal or to hurt. Don Duncan and Hamida Dekhani use language to help. Duncan is a professor at Concordia College, and Dekhani runs the Afro-American Development Association. They regularly take part in a storytelling project called Narrative 4, which pairs up seemingly opposite people to share their stories in an effort to build a more empathetic global society. What are the different focuses of the story exchanges?
Well, the ones we've been doing here in Fargo-Moorhead have been very much focused on immigration and community. And we provide prompts. I provide three prompts with the caveat that if they want to tell something different than what one of those suggests, that's fine. But I always try to have one that sort of has a neutral swing, a negative swing, and a positive swing. So you can kind of figure out, what is the story I want to tell? Is it hilarious? Is it really touching? What is it? So one of the prompts for this immigration and community exchanges that we're doing, and there'll be many more of these across the year, so if people are listening, they can be thinking, oh, what kind of story would I tell? Is tell a story about the first time you ever came to know someone of another culture or another faith. Not the first time you met, but came to know someone of another culture or another faith. And everyone has a story like that. I mean, if you're Catholic and you got to know a Baptist, that's, you know, that's different right there, right? But for us, mostly, you know, it's about immigration. Mm-hmm. The second one is, so that's the neutral one, right? The second one prompt is tell a story about when you have felt marginalized or oppressed. I'm 61. I don't know how you get through life and never feel marginalized at some point. Ask any teenager. But oppressed is a whole different level. And so, you know, that's that negative, painful story. And the third one is tell a story about what community means to you personally by illustrating someone who has represented the best of community to you in your life. There's the positive one.
Also, we talked about the one you will tell a story about when someone first helped you.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Oh, that second one was, yeah, how did somebody help you overcome that marginalization and oppression? Thank you for reminding me of that.
Yeah.
Because that really, you know, that makes a difference.
Yeah.
So, like, if Hamida and I decide to model next time, maybe I'll talk about how my grandmother taught me about community. But I don't know.
I'll talk about my oppression.
Yeah.
But not Islam doesn't oppress me. Society oppressed me.
Right.
So I'll talk about that.
Yeah. What do you mean by that?
Most people think that I'm a Muslim and Islam oppressed me by having my headscarf, right?
Mm-hmm.
But a million years ago, Islam gave women right of basically everything that the society doesn't give. I don't take my husband's name, for example. You know, most of the women are oppressed by taking husband's name. I'm not oppressed by that. I can have my own wealth. I can inherit from my father. So things like that. But people don't know. They think Islam oppressed me. But when I say society does, it's like, you know, all these labels. People put, they see so many labels than who I am. You know, for example, people just look at me and they see black woman. They look at me, they see Muslim, they see immigrant. So all that oppressed me because I just want to be a human. Mm. That's all. You know, I'm just a human just like any other human. But people don't see that. That is an oppression by just people trying to put you down for just who you are. Then Islam has nothing. Like, I am so happy to be Muslim. Islam is not oppressing me. Actually, it is empowering me. It's just quite opposite than oppression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are the times that you feel like Islam most empowers you?
Like right now, whatever is going on in this world, not just in the United States, but in the world. I live in a country that my own president banned my people to come in, you know. So I feel like I am powerful that the president is thinking of how to kick me out. So that's power. So, yeah.
Well, yeah. That's one way to flip a story on its head.
Yeah. Oh, well, when we met for coffee last week and we were talking about coming in, you know, we both talked about our faiths. You know, I'm Christian. We both pray. We both share scriptures. There's so much that we can do in our world through storytelling to help dismantle ignorance and dismantle hatred and come to know. I mean, I was sitting here watching Hamida talk to you, and I was thinking to myself, I am so grateful to know this woman. My life is so much richer because I know her, and I wouldn't know her probably if not for Narrative 4. You know, I'm just incredibly blessed by this work and by the people it brings into my life. So,
when you say dismantle ignorance, dismantle hate, is that part of why 80% of this takes place, 80% of Narrative 4's work is in the education system? This is something that you have to start at a young age?
It is indeed, yeah. I think that can happen at any age, but it's much harder as we become adults and we have these entrenched ideas about how life works and who we are. And I have great hope. I'm an optimist. There's a child in me still. But it is much easier if you begin young. And Morehead Public Schools are partnering with us. We're doing an exchange here in Morehead through Continuing Education on October 14th, a day-long exchange. And we're going to begin to try to integrate some of this into the schools. And then Leah Joke at South in Fargo, she would like to try using Narrative 4. And if we can begin to get it into our schools here, too, where it's a tool. It's not a solution. I want to be really clear about that. Narrative 4 is not a solution. It's a tool. It's a process for building genuine relationships. Because it's not just about the event of the story exchange, but all that leads up to it and all that happens after. We have a friendship, right? We don't walk out the doors after that event and forget about each other.
It's not just also just a tool, but also it's a skill. You're going to learn how to engage and connect with people in a human level. It's a learning. It's a knowledge. Just you think like it's just you're telling your story, so what is the big deal about that? But through my story, you're going to learn to be courage, to speak out, and then you will have the interest of knowing more. You will learn how to be connected with people in the community and what matters to you. You will learn so many things. It's not just a story. I was one human being that I only listen when I want to respond. If I don't want to respond to you, I don't listen to you. So with Narrative 4, you will listen, not just to listen, but you're walking with this person along from the beginning to the end. So it's a good skill, which I lacked. I wish I should do this ahead of time when I was in school. I should listen to my professors very well, I guess.
You're never too old to learn lessons.
And each story is like 7 to 10 minutes. So if you imagine, like, we're having a conversation here, but if we were telling our stories, if you listen to someone for 7 to 10 minutes and never interrupt them, that's amazing, especially in this world where we're looking at our phones and we're doing, you know, we're distracted by so many things. But to actually gaze into the eyes of another person intently for 7 to 10 minutes and just listen.
Yeah.
And, and some of the stories are just so emotional.
Yeah.
So you are listening and you are somehow crying and all that. So that is a skill. Mm-hmm. You are doing two things together and you're concentrating and connecting.
I've talked to some grief counselors and people in similar professions in the past, and one common theme among people who work in healing is how to not take on that other person's pain when you are trying to empathize. Is that hard?
Well, I think the whole idea for the storytelling and exchanging is not to feel sympathy. It's not to feel for the person.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be with the person. Mm-hmm. You will have the connection. You will have the emotional everything. But you are not in a point to say, oh, the poor thing. Oh, the story is sad. So the fact that you are not judging this story is sad or anything, that will keep you the distance of, you know, saying, keeping it to yourself.
Wow, you said that really well, I have to say. Thank you. One of the things that we do is we always have a social worker or counselor with us so that if somebody does get so moved that they have difficulty and it's beyond what we are capable of helping them with, you know, because we're facilitating the whole, right, then they're able to step out with them. And we have ambassadors. So like Hamida has been a participant, so now she could be an ambassador for a future one. And she'd be maybe the first point person to go out with that person.
Okay.
And then if they needed the counselor or the social worker, we'd bring that person out. So we have that if we need it. But we also know that the one telling the story is the person originally sharing is in charge of what they share, right? So I don't say to Hamida, oh, tell me your deepest, darkest secret. That's not what it's about, right?
True.
And because it's not a counseling session.
Mm-hmm.
But I think she just taught me something really powerful about that difference of why can, you know, we're working so hard to carry the privilege of that person's story and have the responsibility because we're sitting right next to each other telling it, right? That we want the clarity to be able to tell it. And that's another reason we don't practice sympathy, the feel for, which puts me up here and you down here, right? But the moving with, the true empathy, the moving with and alongside. And to do that, you have to have clarity of mind. You have to you have to be able to tell the story. And
be true to, you know, what you're telling. You're given a big gift to make a meaning out of someone's life or someone's secret.
Mm.
Some people shared very personal stories.
Mm.
So you go... You don't just go there to just talk. You will put a lot of thought in it and say in a way that it represents them very well with respect and trust and make meaning out of that.
Yeah. I think one of the really important parts of there are a lot of different narrative processes that are being used today to work in restorative justice and reconciliation and the gathering of our grandparents' stories before we lose them and, you know, immigrants and, you know, so there's, you know, there's StoryCorps and there's Green Card Voices. There's a lot of different ones. They're all important, and they each one do something different. The first-person exchange is critical, and I think part of it is because it really lives out equality. I'm so used to hearing people say to immigrants, tell us your story. And then we refuse to make ourselves vulnerable enough to tell our own. Here, everybody is we're at the same juncture of making ourselves vulnerable to one another, same need to trust one another. And it's a real equalizing force. And that's a goal for us, you know, that there's this sense of true equality that is lived and not just, you know, sort of a theory.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll ask this to both of you, and it's okay if the answer is not narrative form. When was the first time you felt heard?
My grandmother always heard me. She was the most important person in my life. She never told me to spit it out, speak more quickly, shut up, none of that. So she really heard me. And then there were teachers who heard me. And then the very first story exchange when I realized Karen, my partner, really heard me, a stranger, but no longer a stranger, really heard me.
For me, I think all my life, because I've been raised in a big family. Grandparent lived with us, and then have uncle and aunties. If even the parents are busy to listen, you have always there's someone who will listen to you in the house, you know, either your elder siblings or your uncle, your grandparent. So I've always been listened, and but the one that those were the childhood time, but the one that I felt someone listened to me clearly was when I just started school in NDSU. I had this very amazing counselor. So when I go to her office, she always listens to me, and she always have a word of encouragement. And after I left the office, I always feel that, oh, I have someone to talk to.
Dawn, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you very much for having us.
Hamida, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dawn Duncan and Hamida Dekhani sharing more on the story exchange effort called Narrative 4. Dekhani runs the Afro-American Development Association, and she's also a student at North Dakota State University, studying emergency management and international studies. Duncan is a professor of English and Global Studies at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota. She's Narrative 4's project manager for the Dakotas in Minnesota. There are a number of story exchanges coming up, including in Moorhead, Bismarck, Botno, and Watford City. If you're interested in starting one, you can email her at duncan@cord.edu. Coming up next on this Labor Day, we consider the value of work.
Hi, I'm Cassie Shipley, Donor Relations Coordinator for Prairie Public. If you're a sustaining member, we can't thank you enough. Your generous monthly contribution provides a reliable source of funding so we can bring you high-quality programming and fact-based, independent journalism. Plus, you help bring down the costs of mailing out pledge reminders. And of course, it's greener for the environment. So we know you enjoy the little extra benefit of saving Prairie Public money. But here's where we could use your help again. Expired and renewed credit cards can stop a sustaining membership in its tracks. But that can't happen when you set up your monthly deduction via a checking account. So make the switch. All we need is your bank's routing number and your account number. That's it. So make your monthly gift to Prairie Public count even more by switching your sustaining membership to a checking account monthly deduction. It's easy to do. Just call me, Cassie Shipley, at 800-359-6900, extension 538, or email at sustainer@prairiepublic.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Today is Labor Day. The first Monday in September is set aside as a federal holiday honoring this country's labor movement. Whether you're living paycheck to paycheck, regularly, say TGIF, or get a case of the Mondays, our work lives and our lives are sometimes hard to separate. Jack Russell Weinstein is a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota in Grand Forks. He also hosts the radio show Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. It airs the second Sunday of the month on Prairie Public's radio service at 4 o'clock Mountain, 5 o'clock Central. On this month's episode, he visits with Rutger Bregman. The journalist has written four books, the most recent, Utopia for Realists and How We Can Do It. In this excerpt from The Why Show, they discuss the meaning of work and how that relates to the idea of a guaranteed income, even for those without jobs. Weinstein told Bregman he's recently focused on his health and happiness more and his job less, and wonders about some of that guilt that comes when society says that if we're not contributing to productivity, that we're not being responsible.
Well, it's interesting that if you look at what so many of the greatest thinkers of the 20th century believed, many of them basically said that we would be working less and less and less. I mean, there's this famous essay written by John Maynard Keynes, the British economist. He published it in 1930, and he argued that, well, he basically made two predictions. First, the first prediction was we're going to get a lot richer, about 4 to 8 times as rich in 2030, he believed. And, I mean, he was right about that. We are already more than 5 times richer than we were back then. The other prediction he made is that, well, if we just keep on doing what we've been doing since 1850, which is trade a little bit of our increased prosperity, a little bit of our economic growth for a little bit of extra leisure time, well, then the work week will keep shrinking and shrinking and shrinking, and in 2030, we'll have a working week of about 15 hours. Now, the thing is that that may seem crazy to you, like, oh, Keynes, whatever, he was a weird socialist economist, but almost everyone believed this. You know, all up until the 70s, almost all the economists, sociologists, philosophers, they all believe that the work week would shrink and shrink and shrink. I mean, Isaac Asimov, for example, the great science fiction writer, he argued that the greatest challenge of the future was going to be boredom. And he believed that the biggest profession of the future would be the psychologist, because they would have to treat all those people who are suffering from the symptoms of boredom. Well, I mean, he was right. The psychologists, indeed, today they are one of the biggest professions, but they're not treating the symptoms of boredom. You know, they're treating the symptoms of depression, and people are completely burned out because they work way too hard. So around 1980, in all of the Western world, we started working more and more and more. It's one of the big questions of our time, like what happened back then?
When I visit Vienna, which is one of my favorite places to be, mm-hmm. I lived there for a while. I have lots of friends there. I always tell them Americans don't understand leisure. We think we're supposed to be working out, right? We're supposed to be doing something. And this idea of sitting in a cafe and just talking, or just sitting there and looking. This is another thing, right? Because of phones, we've lost the ability to stare into space, right? We mm-hmm. have to look at our screens. We can't just be there. And it's interesting to hear that that's a Western phenomenon rather than just an American phenomenon, because of course I think you're right, and I'm a little older than you, and I remember mm-hmm. 1988, and I remember that shift, and I try to figure out what my life would look like, or what everyone's life would look like, if we worked less. And again, this is a lack of imagination. What would I do with a 15-hour work week? Mm-hmm. There is a sort of a school of thought, the Weberian capitalism and the Protestant work ethic kind of notion mm-hmm. that, well, if you're not working, you're not a valuable human being.
Yeah. You know what's interesting here is that if we compare countries, you know, in an international perspective, it's actually the countries with the longest working weeks, like Japan, Turkey, and yes, the US, where people watch the most amount of television. So it's pretty interesting. You know, if you've been working so hard and sending emails to people you don't really care about all day, or writing reports no one reads, then yeah, you're completely burned out at the end of the day, and the only thing you can do is watch Netflix, Gilmore Girls, whatever, you know, to at least have a little bit of happiness in your day. In countries with much shorter working weeks, we see that they have much more social capital, that they devote more time to volunteers' work, have more time for the kids and the elderly, etc., etc. So my argument is that if we work less, do less paid work, we can actually do more really valuable, often unpaid work.
I've been trying to step back from work and be healthier. And so my wife and I went on this trip to the North Shore of Lake Superior. For those people who are in the Midwest, this will be familiar, but it's this wonderful resort area, but with hiking and mountains, insofar as the Midwest has mountains. And we ended up spending a fair amount of money for 3 nights. And then I took a renewed interest in camping, and we've been buying some equipment to camp. And it's expensive. And my wife is concerned that we're spending too much money. And I said to her, first of all, no matter how much we buy, it's going to be less than what we spent for 3 days. But we are spending the money to have basically free vacations for the next 5 years until the equipment runs out. This influx of money gives us freedom to live cheaper in the future. And this influx of money gives us the flexibility to do something at one time that we couldn't do if we had to space it out over a long period of time. And so, Rutger, I tell this story because this notion of having money at once and that flexibility of a large influx, this is the centerpiece of the idea of universal basic income, right? That mm-hmm. that there's stuff that we can do with a chunk of money that we can't do with small pieces laid out over time. Is that correct?
Yeah, and like you said, it's also an investment. So it might cost money up front, but there is an extraordinary amount of evidence that, for example, eradicating poverty is an investment that pays for itself in the long run, because you get lower healthcare costs, you get lower crime rates, kids perform better in school, you know, people pay more taxes, they get better jobs, etc., etc., etc.
So let's start then from the definition, as we philosophers like. Tell us what universal basic income is and how does it work?
Well, I always like to start with the idea of a guaranteed basic income. That is really, to my mind, the umbrella concept. And the idea of a guaranteed basic income is to give everyone in a certain society, most often we talk about the nation state, a minimum income. So there's simply no way you can get beneath or under the poverty line anymore. What's very important is that it's completely unconditional. As you know, nowadays we have a welfare system that does some things for the poor sometimes, but it's absolutely not unconditional. You know, there are more and more conditions attached to getting welfare these days. So it's unconditional, it's individual, and there's one form of the basic income guarantee, which is also universal, and that would mean that everyone would get it, whether you're rich or poor, employed or unemployed, doesn't matter at all.
So everyone gets $15,000 on April 2nd.
Something like that.
I guess I'm confused. What do you mean by everyone gets it in this first model of general income?
Well, there were big basic income experiments, for example, in the 70s in the United States. This is a pretty fascinating episode in American history that is almost completely forgotten nowadays. And these were not experiments with the universal basic income, but with what we call a negative income tax, which is a form of basic income. It will mean that your income is topped up as soon as you fall below the poverty line. Now, I must say that technically this is pretty much the same as universal basic income, because if everyone would receive a basic income, you know, many of them would also have to pay more taxes to fund the basic income. So it might even happen that, you know, you get a basic income but have to pay the same amount in additional taxes, so nothing will really change. What I believe is really essential to basic income in any case is that it provides a floor in the income distribution. That is what is most important about it. So the unconditionality is more important than the universality, in my mind.
So if someone finds themselves in a circumstance, let's say the poverty level is $20,000 a year for a couple. I would hope it's more than that. But let's say the poverty, just for math's sake, $20,000. If you find yourself earning less than $20,000, the government's going to make up the difference. If you find yourself without a job and you have no income, the government is going to give you $20,000. But if you're making $100,000, you're well above that floor, so you won't get anything, but the taxes you pays for the $20,000 or the $500 that other people get.
Exactly. So a life without poverty would become a right instead of a privilege. And as I said, this almost happened in the United States. There is no country that came as close to having this kind of basic income as the U.S. Richard Nixon, of all people, almost implemented it. He got his proposal for this basic income through Congress twice. And ironically, it was killed by the left, by the Democrats, because they wanted a higher basic income.
This part of the book made me want to throw the book against the wall, because you argue it wasn't the Republicans that killed this. It was the Democrats.
No. As I said, it's a completely forgotten episode of American history. At the end of the 60s, almost everyone believed that some form of basic income was going to be implemented. You know, John Kenneth Galbraith, the famous leftist economist, he was in favor of it. But Milton Friedman, the neoliberal economist, thought it was a good idea as well. So what Richard Nixon said is, all right, well, if everyone believes in this, sure, let's do it. It's just pure coincidence that it didn't happen. There's no big reason. You know, the idea was finally killed in 1978 when new results from a Seattle basic income experiment came in. And the results were really, really positive. So healthcare costs went down. As I said, kids did better in school. No, people didn't work any less. So it was a quite positive experiment. But the only problem was that the researchers found out that the divorce rate had gone up by 50%. So at that point, all the conservatives said, look, we can't have basic income. You know, this will make women much too independent. We can't have this. It was only 10 years later that researchers found out that a statistical mistake had been made. So in reality, the divorce rate did not go up at all.
And this is actually a pattern that you point out in history, that people who – that the studies or the experiments with universal basic income often look at the outset like they don't work, but it turns out that people falsify the data. Can you talk about – and here's a British town I don't know how to say – Speenhamland. Can you talk about this town in England and what they did and what we thought happened and what actually happened?
Well, this is probably the oldest basic income experiment that ever happened at the beginning of the 19th century. It started in Speen, a place in England, and it was developed because the British they were sort of afraid that the French Revolution would arrive at their shores. So they developed this sort of basic income-like system. Now, what happened is that in 1834, a report was published about this system, the Speenhamland system, and it was a very damning report. You know, it was the first time that a government really, you know, devoted a lot of resources and energy to do a proper study of a certain policy that it had enacted, and it showed that the basic income was just a complete disaster. You know, that the poor turned out to become very lazy, didn't work anymore. Marriages were broken, etc., etc. And this had a very, very long legacy. Even the shadow of Speenhamland stretched all the way to Richard Nixon, actually, who sort of changed his mind about basic income. And this is one of the important reasons why it didn't come to pass in the U.S. in the 1970s, like 150 years later. You know, it was only around the same time that historians discover that this report about the supposed failings of the Speenhamland system was a complete fabrication. You know, that the researchers had just invented most of the statistics, that they had made up a lot of interviews that didn't really happen, and that they pretty much based their judgment of the system on what some local religious people were saying. So it's a bizarre history full of crazy ironies.
So in a few minutes we'll get to the philosophical concerns and elaborations, but there is of course a practical one that all of my listeners are thinking now, which is simply this is too expensive. Sure, we could give everyone this $20,000, but then we'd go broke. It would be unaffordable. It's just unrealistic on the economic sense. Could you talk a little bit about maybe Uganda or other places that show, and your argument for the fact that actually, and this is what's, as a pragmatist, this is very, very intriguing, that actually universal basic income is cheaper than letting people be poor.
Yeah. What I think we really cannot afford is poverty. You know, poverty is just incredibly expensive. There's one study from the US that shows it's about $500 billion each year. And then I'm just talking about child poverty. It's an extraordinary waste of human potential. And if you just look at the amount of money you need to completely eradicate poverty, to get everyone in the U.S. above the poverty line, it's about $175, maybe $200 billion. So the cost of child poverty, $500 billion. Eradicating poverty, $200 billion. It's actually cheaper. You know, the math isn't very difficult here. Why don't we do it then? Well, it's not. There's not an economical or technical reason for it. It's just ideology. It's ideology that is holding us back. We have this completely mistaken view that the poor are irresponsible, that they're lazy, that they would waste the money, while we've got a mountain of scientific evidence that proves time and time again that most people want to make something of their lives. Most people are quite creative, and we just have to give them the means to get up and do something.
Rutger, thank you for putting something on the table that really needs to be talked about.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
That was Jack Russell Weinstein, who hosts the radio show Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. His guest, Rutger Bregman's most recent book is Utopia for Realists and How We Can Do It. The entire episode will air on September 10th on Prairie Public's radio service at 4 o'clock Mountain, 5 o'clock Central. Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Fort Union Trading Post National Historic Site, west of Williston on Highway 1804, a place of extraordinary people from different nations building community together in new and often trying circumstances. Unearth the past, discover today.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 4th. North Dakota remembers World War I. At the beginning of the war, German nationals in the U.S. without citizenship were monitored.
In North Dakota, there wasn't any widespread mistreatment, but U.S. District Attorney Melvin Hildreth of Fargo advised German nationals to obey the law and keep your mouth shut. Facing harsh censorship, some German newspapers elected to cease publication. However, the Emmons County Record added a full section in German in August of 1917. German aliens were required to sign up for the draft, but even if their number was drawn, they weren't required to serve. Other resident aliens were also exempt, like many young Canadian men subject to the draft in Canada who sought refuge in the United States. German nationals in North Dakota were tolerated as long as they were quick to buy bonds, pledge their allegiance to the United States, and otherwise support the war. Those who failed could find their name in the newspaper and be shunned by the local community, or worse. Full protection under the law was not afforded to aliens. Although not charged with anything, Harry Merrick, working with a threshing crew in North Dakota, was detained in Portal and placed in the Ward County Jail for over a month simply for being a German national. Even those who had homesteaded in the state and had filed a declaration of intention to become a citizen found that citizenship was not guaranteed. On this date in 1917, a naturalization hearing was about to be held in district court in Fargo to grant citizenship for 20 men from a number of European countries. However, an 1802 law prohibited naturalization for immigrants from enemy nations during times of war. That meant that citizenship was denied for four of the men. German nationals Josiah Bosch, Otto Ohm, Albert Rettke, and Charles Miller. All but one would have to wait until the end of hostilities. A change in the law in May of 1918 opened the door for Albert Rettke. Upon submitting a letter declaring that he would spend a considerable portion of time studying to become a loyal and useful citizen, he was granted citizenship on November 6th, 1918, only 5 days before the war ended. Three from Austria were naturalized, even though Austria fought on the side of Germany. The lack of a formal declaration of war against Austria made it possible for the men to become citizens. While no widespread mistreatment of Germans here was initially evident, it should be noted that as North Dakota soldiers began dying on the battlefields of France, tensions did mount, and expressing pro-German sympathies was risky. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jim Davis. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
That's it for this Labor Day edition of Main Street. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow for more great conversations across the state. Until then, enjoy the rest of your holiday weekend.